Are you feeling stuck in your social work career, wondering if you're even on the right path? You're not alone, and that's why I created the Career Clarity Challenge. In just 5 days, you'll reflect on your values, discover your strengths, create a simple action plan, and learn how to use supervision as a real tool for growth. By the end of this challenge, you'll feel clearer about what matters, more confident in your strengths, and ready to take your next step. Sign up today. It's free, it's practical, and it could be the reset you've been waiting for. Just head to the show notes to join the Career Clarity Challenge now.
Hello, and welcome back to the collaboration between Inside Social Work and Becoming an AMHSW, the podcast, with me, Ashton Hayes.
And me, Marie Vakakis.
So this week we've been talking about all things money, and today we're going to discuss we don't have to work for free. What are your thoughts on that, Marie?
I'm just, my smile's just, you can't capture that on audio. I loathe that sentiment that we should work for free. We work for money. Mm-hmm. So if I was working for free, it's volunteering.
Right.
But I have heard that time and time again, and not about other industries. It's very specific to the work we do. That's seen as somehow we should do it because we care, mm-hmm. and we somehow care less if we get paid. Mm-hmm. And yet I don't get a discount on my hex debt, my mortgage, my car. I don't get cheaper petrol or cheaper groceries or cheaper, I don't know, whatever. I don't get a discount on anything else.
Right.
Because I care. So it's just such a, it is a really interesting topic, because I think it should be, our services should be more accessible through government funding.
Yes.
And I'm okay with a private market sitting alongside public health.
Yes, I am too. I think a private market sitting alongside public health expands accessibility, because we have people who need to use a public health provider, and there are people who have the means to access a private provider, and that means that then there is plenty available. If we have everybody funneled into one area, I think that diminishes availability. I think that the idea of not getting a discount on anything else is really interesting. I wonder what it would be like to walk into the bank and say, I'm a social worker, can I have a few points off my interest rate? Or walking into a petrol station and saying, I'm a social worker, can I have petrol for 50 cents off per litre than others do, because I'm in caring work and therefore my care is not to be monetized. I can only imagine the responses we would get from that. And I think this idea of thinking about the concept of traditional social work, when I type that into Google, nowhere does it say traditional social work is about not being paid for the work that you do. Nowhere says that. And I think that when we sit in a space of asking for social workers to provide their services for less or for free, all we do is create an understanding that all social workers are to be undervalued. And I think that that is a really worrying idea.
When I was doing some research for this topic, one of the things that came up was around access to services, but also fee transparency. And I think that's a bit that is really interesting, of a lot of people don't put their fees out there, and they kind of want to have like a sliding scale, or they're not really clear. And I don't agree with that. I think you can have a sliding scale, but I think you, or a low fee policy, but trying to have this airy fairy hodgepodge, let me just see maybe what could be possible. Mm-hmm. It's bad business. Mm-hmm. And you're a business owner if you're in private practice. Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting thing around how do you sit with someone. And if you didn't listen to our earlier episode looking at our reflections about our social work journey and the AMHSW accreditation, you have a treatment plan. you need to have an idea of roughly how many sessions you think that person might need.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the fee transparency can come in as well, is adjusting expectations. So if someone's coming to you for something like OCD and they've got 10 sessions rebated and you know the literature says that might need 40 sessions,
mm-hmm.
that's where that discrepancy can really cause pain for somebody. So actually being able to say, this is your diagnosis, this is what I'm observing, this is the rebate you get, this is how much I charge, and I think in order to get you the results you want, I might need to see you weekly for nearly a year or fortnightly for nearly 2 years.
Yep.
How do we make that work? And if they can't afford it, you have to make a decision about whether you'll do more harm than good just seeing them for short term or them sporadically coming to sessions because they're trying to stretch out the money because they're too embarrassed to say it. That's when I see that we can run into a lot of problems, when it doesn't feel like it's informed and transparent and openly discussed.
I think that's really, really important, and I agree with you. We do need to discuss the number of anticipated sessions and be able to support someone to assess whether they are able to continue to access our services. And I think that when we think about traditional social work or we think about radical social work, we're thinking about it within the concept of disrupting systems. And so one of the systems that we work in, if you're an AMHSW, but even as a social worker in general, we all work in systems, but we work in a space where mental health has not been prioritized. And irrespective of how grateful we all are about no longer being in lockdown and no longer being confined, the fact is that that was collective trauma. The fact is that there are people still recovering from the impacts of that time. And during that time, we did get an increase of 20 sessions, an increase to 20 sessions that were rebated. And I do think that that was very helpful. And the reduction back down to 10, I think, has been very impactful and lacks insight into the importance of support and trauma-informed interventions post, I hate to use the word unprecedented because, oh my goodness, it's been overused, but an unprecedented event. I think that, now I'm very realistic that the open letter that I put on LinkedIn to our Prime Minister was definitely not seen by our Prime Minister, but it was seen by a lot of other social workers and clinicians in the area of treating mental health who agreed with me, speaking to the fact that AMHSWs are incredibly important members of the treating mental health field, and that not only do we need to be recognised by having the equitable rebate, but also that our clients and any client who accesses mental health is able to do so within an ongoing treatment space that allows for intervention that is going to have tangible outcome.
We'll pop a link to that open letter in the show notes so people can check it out as well. As you were talking about that, one thing that came to mind is thinking about being like a waitress at a fancy restaurant that my salary couldn't afford me to eat there.
Mm.
And sometimes I feel like that in some of our work, that there are times where I couldn't pay what I charge ongoingly without significant sacrifice.
Right.
And so I get that challenge of, I know it's not accessible to everybody. And for some people, they raise funds, they put it on credit, they prioritize that over something else. And there is nothing wrong with you. We're not saying you don't value it if you can't. I think there's this belief sometimes that you would just make it work and you could afford it and you could borrow, steal. For some families, I've worked with some families where multiple children require mental health support and the parents require couples therapy or family therapy. If each one of those charges the recommended fee schedule, that could be over $1,000 a week of therapy. That is out of reach for so many people. So I recognize that that is really hard, and I don't know what the solution is on it about it. And so I feel like our field is forced to think about this more than maybe some others are, and we're expected to do something about it. And when we talk about radical social work, and there's a, well, if you're in private practice, what else are you doing for the community? there are a lot of people I know who work in social work who do nothing for the community. They go into their work, they turn their laptop off at the end of the day, and they go and do their sports and hobbies and play with their kids and live life.
Yeah.
So there is this thing of if you're earning money, you somehow have to justify it by doing even more to give back.
Yes.
Rather than good quality, measured, considered work is good, and that's valuable. And doing timely case notes, comprehensive GP letters, not being burnt out, not being distracted, putting in place the things to provide a good service somehow isn't enough.
I think that is such an important point, because we absolutely advocate and support for social workers closing their laptop at 5 o'clock and going home. No one is putting expectations on people to do more, care, work all day, and then do more afterwards. And so the idea that somebody who charges for their services should do that is quite frankly ludicrous and grossly unfair. There are services available for people to access, and I know that they're grossly underfunded. We are in a position when we charge what we're worth to be able to adjust our services accordingly. We can bulk bill some of our clients if we want to. We can do the sliding scale if we want to. But the thing is, every time somebody leaves a funded service to go into private practice, they create a space in that funded service for somebody else to do that work. So we're operating in an ecosystem that ultimately does provide accessibility. I don't believe that any of us who are private practitioners are out here saying, I don't care anymore. I no longer wish to be accessible. I have cast aside my social work ethics and values. We haven't done that at all. In fact, I would say that most social workers who are long-term social workers, irrespective of whether they're in funded programs or whether they're in private practice, their care continues to become embedded in the provision of the service they provide, which is high-quality care.
I agree. A lot of the work that I've done has been around diversity and inclusion. And so how do I create a space that is queer-friendly, that is neurodiversity-affirming, that is friendly for trans people? How do I advocate for accessibility and referrals within that cohort? How do I – the podcast, I mean, I've been doing podcasting for over 7 years. That's all free. That costs me so much money to and time to produce, and that is done to educate. Mm-hmm. And even as you were saying, you know, we don't expect other people to do all this stuff out of hours. I think a lot of organizations actually do.
Okay.
I think teaching does, nursing does. I think a lot of organized, they expect you to stay back a little bit or help with this fundraiser or do a donation drive. Like, they're still the same people are getting flogged all the time to do more for the place that they work, all in service of other people.
And so I think what I meant when I said that is us as social work supervisors, for example, we wouldn't be putting that on our supervisees.
No.
But yes, you're absolutely right. Service provision in areas that may be overpopulated or more dominantly female do have a tendency to rely on unpaid labour, which embeds this idea to the funders that the work can be done within the limited funding that is given.
Yeah.
And to disrupt that system, we need to demonstrate that it cannot be done. And we need to demonstrate that collectively by supporting each other and not tearing people down because of the career decisions that they've made.
Yeah, absolutely. And even though I agree with all of that, I still can't shake that desire to keep doing some things for free. So for years I coordinated the Mental Health Professionals Network, mm-hmm. which again cost me time and money.
Yeah.
I do podcasting. I've had students on placement. I do mentoring through the AESW and informally and through one of my uni alumni programs. I regularly donate money. I do fun runs. I still can't shake that. And maybe that's not necessarily linked to social work. It might be why social work was interesting to me.
Mm.
And I can't separate it because I was always like, I had a World Vision sponsored child as a teenager. So me before too. I even knew about anything, I was doing the dollar a day when I was literally maybe only earning that much. So I think that that has been embedded in me earlier. And I remember doing fundraisers for the RSPCA and I did my year 10 student placement at the RSPCA. So I've always had that side. And so I'm not sure whether it's a money story, or I think it's more of a, if I can earn more, I can give more. If I can build up my profile, I can help more people. And I don't see money as inherently good or bad. I think it's what you do with it. And it'll be interesting when we talk about money stories next, how that keeps you small or how that can help you grow the relationship you have or the story you have around money and wealth.
Yeah, I think the free work or the giving work that we do, I'm like you, I run a Facebook group that on the face of it may seem like it's not much, but I spend hours and hours researching, looking at questions, making sure that I'm double checking on information, making sure information's correct. That takes out a huge amount of my time, but I do it because I want to do it. I don't feel obligated to do it. And, you know, people have found community there. I, like you, have done, have sought to be in service for the purpose of collectively making a better world for us to live in. I know that was a very grandiose statement. I'm not suggesting I do that, but I think if we all collectively do our bit, it's not about an obligation because of our career. It's incentive to lift everybody up, make a difference for all. We did 40-hour famine back in the day. I don't know why anybody
Me
thought
too,
that
in primary school
children should be going without food for 40 hours. And
I forgot about that. Yeah, I did it in primary school, and I remember measuring how many you could have worth of butterscotch. There was every certain hours you could have a butterscotch.
You could, yeah. Not sure how that healthy that is, and certainly the idea was to reflect that there are kids starving in the world. I think there are probably better ways to do that now that are probably safer. But, yes, the idea of being in service to others is not an obligation but a desire to make things better for all.
And maybe that's part of the values that I was exposed to and grew up with. I remember doing Jump Rope for Heart, so we raised money for heart health, 40-hour famine. That's probably how I got into the sponsor child world. And then I was always interested in the environment and animals. And so I think everyone should be giving something back to some part of their community in some way, shape or form when you can.
Yeah.
That could be, I've heard people do like lasagna clubs where there's like there's an organization that you can volunteer to bake a lasagna and then they allocate that to somebody who's in need of a lasagna.
I love that.
It could be through a church group. It could be through picking up – I pick up bags and bags of trash when I'm out for walks. Like I literally have a bag, like a bag in my pocket so that when I go I can pick up rubbish. It can be through paying something forward. So those little community library books, there are ways to help, and I think – that's just nice when everyone can do. And I love models around saving money, like the Barefoot Investor that hasn't allocated money for giving in some way, shape or form. And I think that's because being ACTI-based, ACT-trained, it aligns with values.
Yeah.
And I can value community, and I can choose to do that in a number of ways through time, energy, money, and contribute in a number of different areas. So I guess what we're saying is we shouldn't work for free, but there are ways that we can contribute, support each other and value that work and that time, that investment, hex debt, ongoing training, the expenses of keeping current and up to date.
I absolutely agree with you.
So stay tuned. Tomorrow's episode, we're going to be talking a little bit more about money, but we're talking about money stories and money blocks. So stay tuned. I think this is going to be a really juicy episode. Are you feeling stuck in your social work career, wondering if you're even on the right path? You're not alone, and that's why I created the Career Clarity Challenge. In just 5 days, you'll reflect on your values, discover your strengths, create a simple action plan, and learn how to use supervision as a real tool for growth. By the end of this challenge, you'll feel clearer about what matters, more confident in your strengths, and ready to take your next step. Sign up today. It's free, it's practical, and it could be the reset you've been waiting for. Just head to the show notes to join the Career Clarity Challenge now.